Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to the folks from Coffee Kids and see what they are up to these days. Right now, I'd like to welcome from the New Mexico Environmental Law Center, Doug Mickeljohn. He's the executive director, and Eric Jantz, who is a staff attorney there. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's a pleasure to be here.
Doug, why don't you tell us a little bit about the New Mexico Environmental Law Center?
Certainly. Let me just add to what Eric said. We really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. The Law Center is a private, nonprofit, tax-exempt law office. We provide free and low-cost legal services for people who are working to protect the environment in New Mexico. And probably about 70% of the work that we do is for communities that are low income. Most of the communities we represent are also communities of color. They're predominantly Hispanic or predominantly Native American communities.
Do you find yourself representing individuals or community groups within those communities?
Generally speaking, it's community groups, although there are some situations in which we've represented units of government, primarily tribes. We represent the Taos Pueblo on some issues relating to the proposed expansion of the Taos Airport. We represent a division of the Acoma Pueblo in connection with proposed uranium mining that would adversely affect the Acoma Pueblo and its members. We also do work all over the state for other communities, for community groups such as Amigos Bravos in Taos, the Gila Resources Information Project in Silver City, the Colonias Development Council in Las Cruces. We've worked pretty much everywhere in the state.
What you're saying does really bring up some big questions that I think people have heard about regarding environmental justice, namely that a lot of environmental dumping or environmental hanky-panky of various negative kinds happens in poor communities and the most vulnerable communities of color.
There isn't any question about that at all. The place where industries see the least political resistance being able to be mounted to environmental pollution, environmental challenges, is in communities that don't have political power. And those communities, unfortunately, generally are communities of color and low-income communities. And that's why proposals, for example, to put in new landfills occur in communities like the South Valley of Albuquerque, like Chaparral, and not in the Northeast Heights of Albuquerque or Las Campanas, exactly, yes.
So let's talk about some of the work you're doing as it relates to the New Mexico legislative session. There's a bill that would affect how local communities can make rules or not make rules about oil and gas drilling.
Yeah, Mary Charlotte. Senate Bill 17 is introduced by Senator Carol Lavelle. Is a piece of legislation that's purpose is to restrict local governments, counties and cities from regulating oil and gas in any fashion. And my suspicion is that this is pretty clearly a reaction to the success of the Santa Fe County Oil and Gas Ordinance.
Tell us a little bit about the Santa Fe County Oil and Gas Ordinance.
Well, the Santa Fe County Oil and Gas Ordinance is the first of its kind in the country. It's probably the most comprehensive protective ordinance that any county in the nation has passed. It doesn't prohibit oil and gas exploration and production, but it does make sure that oil and gas producers take a very close look at the environmental consequences of their operations, as well as bear the cost for those operations, rather than what economists call externalizing the costs on the community.
It is interesting that to see what happens when you do try to do potentially environmentally destructive stuff in a community that does have some wealth and political power.
Yeah, I mean, this was a really fascinating example of democracy at work. I mean, the people in the community heard about what was going on in their community. They organized and pressured their decision makers to do the right things to protect both the public health and the environment that they live in.
And so protecting public health in terms of specifically drinking water, waste requirements?
All of those things. I mean, before a oil and gas operator can even begin to produce in the Galisteo Basin or Santa Fe County, that producer's going to have to produce some sort of comprehensive environmental and public health report. So everybody knows what's going to happen, or probably happen, once production begins, if it does.
So the bill, Senate Bill 17, which is in front of the New Mexico legislature right now, would prevent precisely bills like that from being passed, from counting.
Yeah, I think the oil and gas industry's greatest fear is that this sort of democratic wave is going to sweep across the state and, you know, the nation, that communities are going to begin to take control of how land and resources are used in their backyards.
So that is something that is coming up. Now, what kind of public support, I mean, what is the public doing about it? What are you guys doing about Senate Bill 17?
Well, we're working with a coalition of folks from the Galisteo Basin. That includes Drilling Santa Fe, Common Ground United, as well as the Oil and Gas Accountability Project. To oppose this piece of legislation. This is an ill-conceived piece of legislation. I mean, the law right now as it stands very clearly allows counties and cities to regulate certain aspects of oil and gas, and we believe that's the way it should be.
So there is state law that specifically says counties can regulate oil and gas, and this would counteract existing laws.
Yeah, it would basically divest counties in the future of having that sort of responsibility and power.
So let's talk about another aspect of oil and gas drilling, which is the existing pit rule. What is the pit rule?
Well, the pit rule was a regulation promulgated by the New Mexico Oil Conservation Division. It passed this rule in 2000, early 2008.
So this is really basically a brand new rule.
Basically is. And what it does is it regulates the waste generated by oil and gas operations. And before this regulation passed, effectively oil and gas companies could dump their waste in a hole in the ground. And
what is the nature of that waste?
An analysis was done by Theo Colburn at the Endocrine Disruption Exchange. Something like...
Endocrine Disruption Exchange?
Yes, Endocrine Disruption Exchange.
Wow.
Dr. Colburn is a pioneer in the area of endocrine disruptors, that is chemicals that...
So things that mess up your pituitary and your...
Yeah, that mess up your hormones, interfere with hormone production and timing and all those things. Anyway, she did an analysis of what's in oil and gas pits in New Mexico, and something like 80% were toxic in one way or another, either carcinogenic, cancer-causing, or endocrine disruptors, or having some sort of acute effects like liver damage, gastrointestinal damage, eye damage, stuff like that.
So this happens, all these toxins are sitting in pits, and what happens? They leach into the groundwater?
They can. In fact, the Oil Conservation Division has documentation of over 400 instances where oil and gas wastes have contaminated water sources.
Do they also evaporate into the air?
They can, yeah. They can do what's called volatilize. And that's basically evaporating in the air, and they can cause all kinds of problems with health when they're inhaled.
Do you find animals eating them, and then we eat the meat of the? I mean,
that's happened as well. I mean, the main concern is contamination of water and the problems that are associated with breathing the volatilized compounds from these pit wastes.
So all of these, this analysis was done. It was discovered that, which probably a lot of people already had figured out, but it was studied. They passed these pit rules. What is the nature of the pit rules? What do they say?
Well, the pit rules are fairly strict now. They require that all pits be lined. They have an impermeable liner so that the risk of groundwater contamination is greatly reduced. A lot of times it really encourages closed-loop systems, which are systems that don't use pits at all. They recycle a lot of the water that's used, a lot of the wastes that are used, or that are generated, rather. And ultimately, the wastes that are disposed of are trucked off-site and disposed in a hazardous waste facility, a licensed hazardous waste facility. So it really goes a long way to protect groundwater resources and public health. There's been one bill already that's been introduced, House Bill 108, sponsored by Representative John Heaton, that would work to undo some of the protections that the Pitt Rule enacted. And we expect that there may be others to come.
So they want to basically legally undo the brand new rules that the OCD, the Oil Conservation Division, has enacted.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, so we're talking to Eric Jantz and Douglas Mickeljohn of the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. So there is another issue going on having to do with uranium mining in the state of New Mexico.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think as a lot of your listeners probably know, the legacy of uranium mining in New Mexico is fairly lengthy and quite tragic. Abandoned uranium mines and mills have caused billions of dollars, actually, of environmental damage in the northwest part of the state from grants on west. The people who live in those communities continue to be exposed to some of the most toxic chemicals that humanity's been able to conjure up dig up, actually, from the ground.
Yeah, ionizing radiation is very bad for you.
Generally speaking, yes. One of the things that a lot of the folks in those communities are demanding is that all the abandoned uranium mines from the last uranium boom, which lasted from the late 50s till the mid-80s, be cleaned up, because there are thousands out there that are just sitting there irradiating people and animals, contaminating groundwater, things like that, contaminating surface water, that are just sitting there and not having anything done about them. And the companies that caused this mess have either disavowed any responsibility or, have gone out of business long ago.
So if they've gone out of business long ago, what is to be done now?
Well, that it's left for the public to bear the cost of that remediations, those cleanup projects. And, there's a bill in the House right now, House Bill 84, sponsored by Representative Lundstrom, that, ostensibly deals with that issue. But while Representative Lundstrom may be well-intentioned, and I think she is, this bill really doesn't do the trick. I mean, it ties funding for cleanup of old uranium mines to a tax on new production of uranium.
Oh, boy.
So there are really three real problems with it. First, it doesn't really give the Mining and Minerals Division the legal authority to go after responsible parties who are still around. They already have some limited authority to do that, but they could use more. And that way there is some degree of accountability for the people who made the mess. Second, there is inadequate funding. I mean, it's a 2% tax on the extracted value of the uranium.
If I'm understanding you right, it's basically saying you can't clean up your old uranium mess unless you have new uranium mining.
You're not going to get any money for it. Yeah, exactly. And the most optimistic estimates for new uranium mining, if it ever happens, and there's no guarantee that it will, 5 years down the road. So that's, you're sentencing essentially those people who live in those communities to another 5 years of dealing with this contamination.
I was wondering if either one of you could talk about the history of uranium mining in New Mexico a little bit, because it does seem that while the promise of jobs has panned out from time to time, that it's a real boom-bust cycle, and that the long-term benefit to the communities is far outweighed by the health detriments to those same communities.
Well, as a matter of fact, the Law Center recently sponsored a economic study by a professor at University of Montana, Tom Power, who does, you know, has 30 years experience in resource economics, that said basically that there may be some short term, however very modest, economic gains to the state, but fundamentally, the economic driver for New Mexico and much of the West nowadays is the pristine environment. People come here and locate their businesses here because it's a beautiful place to live and a clean place to live in a lot of places. And when that fundamental sort of economic driver is destroyed by industries like uranium mining, then you're basically destroying your economic base.
Well, I imagine that there's an answer to that, namely that the places where they do uranium mining are pretty far away from places like Santa Fe, where the pristine artistic beauty resources seem to be kind of centralized.
They're certainly far away from Santa Fe. For how long? Who knows? I mean, there's plenty of naturally occurring uranium in Santa Fe County, but the places where there is uranium aren't removed from population centers. There are old mills and mines right in the middle of Grants, right in the middle of Milan. There's a proposed uranium mine right in the middle of Crown Point, which admittedly is a smaller community, but you're talking about a community of 3,500 people who have an equal right to a beautiful place and a clean and healthy place to live as anybody in Santa Fe or Albuquerque.
Well, and as we were talking about at the beginning, it's more likely that a uranium mining company will go to a place like that where it's a smaller community and there is not a lot of wealth there to fight uranium mining as there would be in Santa Fe.
That's precisely correct.
So we are talking to the good folks from the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. So what is the issue around, what are the laws? It's the one law that you were talking about that has been introduced so far.
Right.
What are you doing? What is the New Mexico Environmental Law Center's position on that?
At this point, the Law Center is opposing that piece of legislation. It's not beyond any sort of help. I mean, it could be amended to make it better, I think. But until that time, I think we would continue to oppose it. There are some anticipated pieces of legislation, very briefly, that have been endorsed by the Indian Affairs Interim Committee that will probably come up. One being an appropriation for an inventory of abandoned uranium mines. Another being an appropriation for health studies of people who live around abandoned uranium mines.
It's significant, I think, and sort of outrageous that there have been so few health studies.
Well, that's precisely correct, and I think that's a big concern of the folks in the places where uranium mining has occurred. They want to know what's going on in their communities health wise. And then the third appropriation would be for a hydrological survey of the Grants Mineral Belt to see just exactly what water sources remain intact after the last uranium mining boom, what's been contaminated, and the extent of that contamination.
So when groundwater is contaminated by uranium, that means that everybody for X number of miles is basically drinking uranium in their coffee?
Not necessarily, but oftentimes, yes. If they're on a municipal water system, then they wouldn't be, because those systems are subject to the Safe Drinking Water Act, which sets limits on the amount of uranium that can be that comes out of the tap. But a lot of people have private wells, and those are essentially unregulated. Those are the people that we worry about. Those are the people that are actually drinking the water.
So let's turn back to Doug Mickeljohn. There's some other work that the New Mexico Environmental Law Center is doing that's not necessarily about the legislative session right now. But, for example, there was a recent case involving the Gila River area, the Gila Resources and Information Project. Tell us about that.
That was, pardon me, Mary Charlotte, that was a case in which we represent the Gila Resources Information Project, which is trying to ensure adequate and responsible cleanup of the Phelps Dodge copper mines in the Silver City area. And the question that came up in that particular case was whether the New Mexico Environment Department has the right to protect groundwater basically everywhere in the state, or whether Phelps Dodge had the right to contaminate groundwater within its property boundaries. That is, Phelps Dodge was arguing, as long as the contaminated water doesn't get beyond our property boundary, it's okay. We can pollute it there.
And they were saying that water was going to go to the boundary and say, oh, I'll stop now?
I don't remember them making that specific argument, no. But that was essentially what it amounts to. And as you know, and we know, and I'm sure all of your listeners know, groundwater doesn't do that. Groundwater migrates. Groundwater travels. And the Phelps Dodge...
So they were actually saying we can pollute water under our property line and that's okay because it's not going to go beyond our property line. They were actually saying that.
Well, they phrased it a little differently than that. Their argument was that the Water Quality Control Commission, which is the state agency that was hearing this case, should allow them to establish what they called a point of compliance. And the point of compliance would be a point at their property boundary where they had to meet water quality standards, but that they would not have to meet water quality standards inside their property boundary. And if that argument was accepted, that could have potentially disastrous consequences for groundwater throughout the state of New Mexico.
But instead?
Instead, the Water Quality Control Commission rejected that argument and determined that, in fact, the State Environment Department does have the ability and the authority to protect groundwater essentially everywhere in the state. So that was a good result.
And so that was the Gila Resources Information Project was your client, and so that was
yes.
one of the cases you worked on.
Yes, that's right.
Very interesting.
And that's the most common situation for us. We're a law office. We represent clients. And as I said earlier, normally they are local community groups that are facing a particular environmental problem or problems in their area. And since we do not generally charge our clients, we depend for support upon tax-exempt donations and foundation grants and grants from businesses, etc.
And ladies and gentlemen, you can go to the New Mexico Environmental Law Center at nmelc.org and find out more about them, make contributions, call them up, and find out about what's going on. I mean, I keep wondering, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, if we really are moving toward an era of corporate accountability where, for example, a mine that made a mess was legally responsible for cleaning it up. Because as we see in almost every sector of society, you know, profits are privatized and losses are socialized. Do you see progress, Eric Jantz, for example, toward making polluters responsible for pollution?
Well, I think so. I mean, I don't usually tend to be hopeful about some of this stuff, but I am hopeful about this. I have seen over the last few years a number of really important developments here in New Mexico that have shown that democracy is really still alive. The Galisteo Basin, Santa Fe County Ordinance being one of them. And that was a great example of communities coming together to take on sort of corporate interests and protect themselves and their resources from damage. Another example is the 2005 Navajo Nation ban on uranium mining and processing. That was a strictly grassroots effort, a grassroots democratic effort. It didn't come from the tribal leaders, although the tribal leaders ultimately took it on and should be commended for their work on it. But, you know, the idea and the effort initially came from the people who were faced with the problems. And I see a lot in the work, in my work now, in the Law Center's work, these sort of grassroots efforts come into fruition. And so I do think that we are entering sort of a new era, at least in the West, of corporate accountability.
Eric Jantz is staff attorney, and Doug Mickeljohn is executive director of the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. And once again, they are on the web at nmelc.org or just simply nmenvirolaw.org. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
My pleasure.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with the Coffee Kids. Stay tuned to KSFR.